All right. So, I called off class for tomorrow again because it's just too cold. But I checked it out, and next Thursday it is supposed to be up to 40. And so at that, we'll be able to pick it up next week. And I sound like a mad. I'm a California through and through, even still. And talking about 40 like that's good, I sound like a crazy man. Because in California, that's not good at all. But that is good, isn't it, compared to where we are right now. So next week, and hopefully, not just Thursday, but I just looked at Thursday, but I suspect it'll start warming up the whole thing. And so we'll get back to it. I'm kind of excited about the class that anyone can attend or like to start attending. It sounds, we only had one lesson on it so far, but it sounds like it's going to be a pretty good study, very interesting study. As you saw in the bulletin, we're studying, we'll be studying the songs that we sing, and but basically it's a lesson of questions, and so just thought-provoking things from the songs that we sing, nothing about the backgrounds of the song or anything like that, but just the words that we sing and what they mean, and how we can apply them and make application of them, because you know, the songs that we sing are Bible-based, and so we'll have a lot of good conversation, I think. And so if you haven't attended any of those classes, you can start attending if you like, and you'll enjoy, I think, the class. And so, all right, let's get to Amos here. And a few things on my screen. I want to try to get out of my way here without blowing things up. I think I did it. So where we left off last week, we were looking at those three things on the bottom of the screen there under unacceptable worship, which, again, we'll not go over all that. We spent most of our time with musical instruments last week, if you recall, if you're here, just the idea that worship can be unacceptable is news to some people. Like, as you've heard me say many times before, there are many people, maybe most people in the religious world today, kind of think that as long as we worship God, somehow He's going to be pleased, and they don't realize that you can worship God unacceptably, or as Jesus said in Matthew chapter 15, it can be in vain. And we have many examples of that in the Bible, both Old and New Testament. And so those three points on the bottom then look at the various areas where they failed. And so their assemblies were unacceptable, their offerings were unacceptable, and then again their music was unacceptable. But that was the core of how they worshiped God in those areas, particularly the annual trips again to Jerusalem and things. Now, of course, we're dealing with the northern kingdom, so they weren't making those trips, were they? And so they basically had a man-made religion. They invented what they were going to do. And because of that, again, it was all unacceptable. And it just reminds us that, as Jesus said, we must worship God in spirit and in truth. And the truth part of it is very important. The spirit part is just as important. But we need to understand the importance of doing things God's way. And so we saw that that was unacceptable. And then I can't recall how far we got the dearth of justice there. At verse 24, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. As I recall, I think we got this far. But it's sort of interesting that the Israelites were just failing miserable in this area. And you see, again, justice is that correct moral practice in daily personal and social life, which is clearly observable to others. And justice is very important to God. And, of course, righteousness, to have the proper regard for the commandments or an ordinance of God. Righteousness goes beyond that, but that is a part of it. And that's substantiated here by Luke 1 at verse 6. And they were both righteous before God, Zechariah and Elizabeth. You remember? They were righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all of the commandments and the statutes of the Lord. So that was a part of what righteousness was, a very important part of it. And yet again, the Israelites were failing. Oh, you who turn justice to wormwood and cast down righteousness to the earth. So they just forsook those important things. But we need to remember, even when it comes down to the business of worshiping God, he wants righteousness, he wants justice, and if we don't have that, he doesn't want our worship. And that sounds harsh, and it is, but that's just God. And so we need to respect that and learn from the mistake of the northern kingdom. All right. Well, let's go forward then. Let's see if I can get it up. A pervasive idolatry is what he begins to condemn next. And notice verse 25 again. Did you bring me to me sacrifices and offering during the 40 years in the wilderness? And now these verses 25 through 27 are difficult and translated very differently by commentaries and scholars all through the years. But the overall picture is clear. What we do know is that he is condemning their idolatry, that the people of God were immersed in idolatry. And so now, again, did you bring to me sacrifices and offerings during the 40 years in the wilderness? And, well, is he anticipating a yes or no response to that? That's what's up for debate. The question is, did they? What is the history with that? Well, we know that they did offer up sacrifices in the wilderness, but nothing like they would once they occupied the land. And so a lot of scholars, again, think that the answer should be no to that hypothetical question with regard to them, that he's anticipating a no. No, you did. So what would be the point? The point he would be emphasizing is that the being faithful to God didn't depend on all of those sacrifices. They thought, remember, they had a misunderstanding. They're, one of the reasons they were right with God, they knew everything was okay, is because of all of the sacrifices that were involved. And he's saying, no, that doesn't have everything to do with whether you're right or not with God. And so, he could be bringing up that question with the idea that they did offer sacrifices in the wilderness, but God wasn't pleased because what else were they doing in the wilderness? Huh? Worshiping idols. And so now when you do you look at that history, and it's quite shocking that really the Israelites, they brought gods out of Egypt, idols, that is, out of Egypt. And all through those years, they were worshiping false gods on an individual basis. You know, what did they do with all of that? Hide them in their tents or what? I don't know. But they had them. And we have Ezekiel, other places. Don't know the exact, you could look it up. But two or three references to the Israelites committing idolatry with the gods that they brought from Egypt. And so again, that goes all the way back to that period of time. We're not surprised in the days of Amos that they were doing that. And so now Amos, though, is condemning them. Like, this is something that started way back then. This is a reason judgment is coming. You've had all this time to repent. You've had prophet after prophet, judgment after judgment, to get you to stop worshiping these false gods, and you haven't. And And so they continue with this sort of twofold kind. And remember, in their minds, they're totally convinced they're okay. It's all right. Even though that they had those false gods. And then it gets even more difficult with at verse 26. You shall take up Sikoth, your king, and Kion, your star god, your images that you made for yourselves. Now the difficulty in that is even modern translations translate that differently. Now some believe that those terms, Sikoth and Kion, were a Babylonian god, the god of Saturn. And there's no question that that's involved in this. But that word Sikoth is closely related to a word that has to do with the shrine. And so you have other translations. The King James is one of them. Here's the American Standard Version. Yea, and you have borne the tabernacle of your God. So it's picturing them actually, you know, taking a God that they've created and carrying him around in a shrine, a tabernacle, or whatever. And so can we be sure, like, which translation is the more accurate? No. Like, there's scholars on every side, and it really doesn't matter. Again, the main point is they were immersed one way or another, whatever the artifacts exactly were and exactly what they were doing. The fact of the matter is they were idolaters. And again, they were immersed in it. And so you wonder why a woe is coming upon them. And we can see why. And so he says, and I will send you into exile beyond Damascus, says the Lord, whose name is the God of hosts. And so again, a judgment is going to come upon them because of that, because of their ungodliness. All right. So then we come to the second woe. We get to chapter 6. And in chapter 6, there's going to be some shocking things in chapter 6, particularly down beginning at verse 8 towards the end of the chapter. And in the first part of this chapter, we see a waking up of an indifferent people. The Israelites were totally indifferent. There's a lot of ways to describe them. They were complacent. They were self-confident, as we've already seen, and they were totally deceived. Like, they had a strong, false sense of security. And is that, do we see that today, religiously speaking? Yes. A lot of people, like, again, some people just think it's just automatic. You know, everyone who claims to love the Lord and claims to be serving God, they're all okay and everything's great. And no, there have been people deceived from the beginning. Now, this is dealing with God's own people. This is dealing with those who are part of the chosen people. And they are totally oblivious to the fact that they're about to lose their very existence. And they're just totally indifferent towards the whole thing. That makes them, why aren't they listening to Amos? Why haven't they listened to other prophets that have come their way? They're indifferent to it all. And so now Amos begins to condemn them for that indifference, and he brings it out in a very vivid way. At verse 1, he says, woe to those who are at ease in Zion. Now, that's a little difficult there, because what's Zion? And that word evolves, and it means different things. But at first, what is Zion that it referred to? Okay, yes. And what city was it associated with? Jerusalem. And many, many places in the Bible, Zion, Jerusalem, interchangeable. And So what we find here is, and again, if we're really paying attention, this shouldn't surprise us too much, because Amos is dealing with the northern kingdom. But you remember from our earlier studies in the very beginning that one of the first things that he did, he was condemning the nations. And who else did he condemn? Judah. And so some of the things, Amos understood that the southern kingdom was going to hear a lot of this. And even though he's dealing with the northern kingdom right now, it's not going to be too long before the southern kingdom also is going to need some waking up, because they survived 100 years, over 100 years longer than the northern kingdom, because they had some good kings and whatever. But in the end, they were a lot like the northern kingdom. So he's actually condemning the people of God as a whole here. And again, it's not the first time we've seen this in the book of Amos so far. So, you know, it can be kind of confusing, but you remember he's dealing with the northern kingdom specifically. The real judgment to come is going to come upon them, but there's going to be some judgment on Judah too. And because of his language here, and particularly throwing in Zion, then you get the sense that he's just condemning God's people as a whole for their unfaithfulness here. And of course, when you talk about the mountain of Samaria, that then is dealing with the northern kingdom. And what we're finding here, now notice, woe to those who are at ease in Zion. They're complacent. That even the idea, the statement to be at ease in Zion has sort of come to mean, it's an idiom in a lot of places, where just those who are overconfident, those who are just indifferent, and that's what they were. They were at ease in Zion. We don't have anything to worry about. Everything's okay. You have a prophet who is saying, I mean, some very shocking things to you, and they don't care. In fact, it has been pointed out that as we go through the Amos, you find that they're not real hostile. Like there's things that I've even pointed out. Boy, that must have made them mad. But so far, what we actually read, you don't see them being overly hostile. Why? Because they don't care. They're not buying it. Like he is, you know, it's like the old brimstone, fire and brimstone preacher up there, and just really just saying some things, and some people will listen to it and they don't care. Other people might, man, maybe I need to repent. But they don't think anything of it. It's like, it's not even like they don't believe what Amos is saying. It's just, well, yeah, but not going to happen to us. Oh, there might be a day of the Lord. You're saying, now we're kind of thinking the day of the Lord is going to be great and wonderful. You're saying to us, it's going to be a time of judgment. It's going to be terrible. Maybe, but not to us. It'll be the next generation. It'll be somebody else. They're indifferent. So, yeah. Right.
There's some justice there. Well, we're okay down here because God's right. Not dealing with us.
Yes.
You know, he's not letting us go. And maybe that's why they were at ease.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why they'd be included.
I mean, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
no, I think you're right. Like, you would think, and that goes beyond the scope of this, except for, again, he threw in Zion, and so you're right. But when all of it did develop, wouldn't you think that Southern Kingdom would have got themselves together and said, uh-oh, our brothers, they're gone. I mean, man, let's get on the right track. But it didn't happen like that, and the truth is, life doesn't happen like that. Because a lot of this, when I go through Amos, all I can think about is us and the world and judgment that's really coming. And how many people are just like the Jews in the Northern Kingdom? Oh, I hear you. I know what you're saying, preacher, but not worried about it. That's not going to happen to me. We're going to be okay. And that's how the majority of people live in the world, religious people. Live the way we want to. It's not like the atheist who says, no, there's no God, and no, I don't believe in justice. Believe in all of that. Just, I'm going to be okay. So when you think that, you turn a deaf ear to whatever preaching, whatever you read, whatever, it doesn't scare you. Like, these things should have scared them to death. Some of the things that he is saying to them should absolutely shock them, but they're not worried about it. Here's one of the reasons. Now, just remember the background here. So this has to do again with the Northern Kingdom, and I've already said to you, the Northern Kingdom, you know, they both kingdoms are prospering at this time. But it's not just that. They have demonstrated some power. And so when it says up there earlier that those who feel secure on the mountain of Samaria had a natural fortress-like situation there. Like they've, and that, of course, they would have military all in the mountains there. And that's where their trust was. You know, whatever, we're not worried about any enemies. We're not worried about our foes. They were putting their trust not in God, but in their prosperity, in their military might, and those kind of things. And you can see why when you read passages like 2 Kings. Here it says, in the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. But it says at verse 25, he restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of Araba, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel. And so they were militarily successful. Like when I've said to you, their borders were being enlarged and that sort of thing, that wasn't something that the nations around didn't recognize. Judah and Israel at this point were stronger than all their neighbors for the most part. Now, the Assyrians, they're from the north, they're coming. And by now, they have done enough damage to where, you know, everyone's taken notice, and the Jews should too. But their confidence is in their fortress in the mountains of Samaria. And God is with us. Are you sure about that? Look at us. Of course, he's with us. And so that's how they felt. The southern kingdom, of course, with Uzziah. Well, I'll not read that there, but you're familiar with 26, verse 6 through 8. And, you know, that whole context where everything he did was successful until he went and to the tabernacle and tried to do with the job of the high priest and was struck with leprosy. You remember all that. But the point of it is, we read here how territory was expanding and the enemies were being conquered. And they put confidence in that. Like, you know, there's some application. Are we a great country? Yes. Are we a powerful country? Does that mean anything to the salvation of your soul? No. Don't put confidence in things and stuff that's a part of this world. In military might or the possessions that you have, don't trust any of that so far as your soul is concerned. Now, they're a little bit different situation because they were theocracy. We understand the difference, But the point of it is they were blinded in their military might, their prosperity, and they were blinded to the ways, to the will of God. So even when a prophet is coming upon them and trying to get them to repent, they're just, we're at ease. Go bother somebody else with that message. We're good. We're in good shape. And that was the attitude that they had. And who is it that he's really, you know, he's directing this to all, to the whole, the all the people. But the first people that he's targeting are the notable men of the first of the nations. And so the rich and the powerful of the Israelites. Because as they go, really go the people. And that's what we have seen over and over again. You look at the history of Israel, how many good kings did they have? None. And you would like to say, well, but the people rose above that and overcame that, overthrew the king. No, the kings led them into idolatry. The people followed. But that's not lost on God. The shepherds who were so supposed to be shepherding and watching over his people and his flock, they dropped the ball. And the judgment is going to come upon them because of that. So we see a challenge then to the indifferent. And again, a lot of difficulty in some of these things. He says, go over to Calneh and look, and go from there to Hamath the Great, and then go down to Gath of the Philistines. They are better than these kingdoms. Or is their territory greater than yours? So a couple of different ways to look at that scholars have. And the thing that catches you first is probably not right. Like, you think when you read that, what is Amos telling them to do? Well, these are, of course, cities. The first two are cities in Syria. Gath, of course, was a part of the Philistines. And so they're saying these have been conquered. And now Amos is saying, you think everything's going to be all right? Go look at these great cities and take a look at them. If they were so great, greater than you, and they fail, what's going to happen to you? And, you know, that would be pretty good, except for in history, we find that those cities weren't greater than Israel and Judah at this time. So why would he go and show them that? Well, a lot of scholars believe that what Amos is doing here is simply quoting them. And he's demonstrating their arrogance. And so, give you a few examples of what scholars say with that. Verse 2 is puzzling and the subject of a good deal of spilled ink in the commentaries. It may be best understood as an echo of the words of the leadership's spin doctors in their propaganda of military success and security. He's just saying, this is what their leaders were saying to the people. Look at, everything's okay, because look at these cities that were great, and we're greater than they are. And so, don't worry about them and their fate. We're greater than that. Another one said, it seems best to read this verse as a quotation of these boastful, self-reliant leaders of Samaria. They base their security on the fact that no city in the entire region, even though they had been distinguished in ancient city-states, could now compare in pomp and circumstances with Samaria. And just one more, there's several. Amos is ironically repeating the propaganda handout of the rulers who kept up the morale of the people by drawing advantageous comparisons with reasonable, distant, and clearly inferior places. And so the point of it all is this, what the rulers were doing. they were comparing themselves to some of these nations around them and saying, yeah, they've had some problems, but we're great and we're prosperous and we're expanding. And so we don't have to worry about that at all. And it was arrogant. And so they were so arrogant in all their luxuries and all their military might. When you have that kind of arrogance, it can blind you to what's really going on. And what you need to understand is what's really going on. The Assyrians are knocking on the door. And they're about to break the door down. And what happens in reality, in real life, is they never open their eyes and wake up to that. It's just, oh, we're great, we're wonderful, and we don't have to worry about anything. Until they found themselves, when they find the judgment coming upon them, and it's too late to act. And they get completely brutalized by the Assyrians. And so Amos is just warning them about this and their attitude that they have. Then we see the hedonism caused by the indifference, and this is kind of shocking. So here they are again. They don't care. They're very complacent. They have a false sense of security. All of that. What does that lead to? What does that lead? You go through life and you just think everything's great. Basically living the way you want to. And they developed an attitude that, I mean, they were just living, and we've already seen this at Amos, they're living lives, the rich particularly, that are very luxurious, to the point that it's disgusting. And Amos really paints a picture here of all of that. Here it is again. Oh, you who put far away the day of disaster. That surprise you from what we've already seen? What's the day of disaster? Right. That day of the Lord was coming. But they're saying, no. We don't have to worry about that. They just put it off. They didn't literally. They couldn't put the day off themselves, but in their minds, they ignored it. They didn't care about it. Yeah, but Amos, an inspired prophet, a man of God, he's telling you, it's what I was saying before. It's not like they don't believe. Okay, Amos, maybe a day is coming, a day of judgment. Maybe there's going to be a day of disaster for somebody, but not us. See, and then he says that, and bring near by that attitude that they have, this day is afar off. They bring near the seat of violence, and we're not surprised by that. Violence begets violence. We have seen these people, the rich and the wealthy, doing what? What was one of their main crimes? Oppressing the poor. And doing very violent things. I mean, we're not talking about thugs from the street. We're talking about rulers, talking about judges, taking bribes and allowing people to be abused, all of that. And so when you have that going on, that breeds violence. And what is interesting is when you see a statement like this, that Jeroboam, remember the second, he's the one who is, they're really prospering. But after he died, of all the kings of Israel that were left, they were all, except for one man, they were all assassinated. Only one king after Jeroboam, in other words, passed the kingship to his son. Only one. Every other one reigned for just a short period of time, and someone took him out. It was just very violent, see. And Amos is a prophet. He's seeing this. This is what's going to happen. Because violence begets violence. And that's just the way it is. But look at how they were living. Woe to those who lie on beds of ivory. In other words, they had ivory that were built into the sides of their bed, their wooden beds, and they lived. That was a sign of the rich and wealthy who could do that. Meanwhile, the poor were sleeping on the ground. See? And all of these things are, look, it says, and they stretched themselves out on their couches. Now, that word stretched there is an interesting word because the Hebrew word is a picture of someone who is lying on the couch, outstretched. You just picture it in your mind, arms hanging out, legs hanging off the couch. What is that a sign of? Either laziness or drunkenness or both. And that's the picture that he's painting. Here's what you all look like. This is what you're doing. This is how you're living your life. You're lying on beds of ivory. You're stretched out on the couch. All these other things, you eat lamb from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall. Those were, you know, the high quality food for the rich. And that's what they were eating and feeding upon. Was everybody eating that? No, the poor. They had a lot of, most of the people were oppressed. But the leaders and the rulers, they're living in this state of luxury. It's interesting that he said, you sing idle songs, the sound of the harp, like David, invent for themselves instruments of music. These people were nothing like David. You know who they needed? David. They needed David to come and rescue them. They needed a king with integrity who knew something about warfare, and they didn't care about any of that. They're living lazy, drunken, luxurious lives and think, well, we'll sing songs like David used to and we're good. And so, you know, he's just really painting a vivid picture, who drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils. But it says that they are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. And there's the indifference there. Joseph, the people of God, they're about to fall, and they're not grieving at all. They're too blinded by their wealth and riches and their conceitedness. And so that's the picture of it. That's the description of their indifference. And now he's going to get into a picture of the judgment that's going to come. And it's quite shocking, the language that Amos uses. And we'll look at that next week.